Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday the 28th of August, these are our main stories. The UK government is set to shut down Parliament just weeks before Britain is due to leave the EU. Is this getting the job done or a betrayal of democracy? We'll hear different viewpoints from across British politics and from Brussels. And
one of the biggest threats my people face today is our government. They are trying to destroy the Amazon, to exterminate our people.
After Brazil's president accepts help with tackling the Amazon fires, indigenous communities give us their response to the crisis. Also in this podcast,
there's a lot more work ahead and a lot more money needed to stop the tide of overdose drug deaths, to treat the people who are addicted, and to actually prevent this crisis from just getting worse and worse.
As the US opioid crisis continues, will an offer of money by a drugs firm help to tackle the problem? And what happened when Costco opened its first store in China? The UK government is set to shut down Parliament just weeks before the country is due to leave the European Union. If that happened, it could mean opposition politicians wouldn't have time to stop the Prime Minister Boris Johnson taking the UK out of the EU without a deal. Mr Johnson insists that politicians would have enough time to debate Brexit. But the First Minister of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, has said it would be a dark day for democracy. Pauline Latham, a pro-Brexit Conservative MP, supports Mr Johnson.
I'm very relaxed about Boris Johnson doing what he needs to do to get Brexit through. That's what the country wants. That's what the country voted for. We don't want a no-deal Brexit. Clearly, it would be much better to leave with a deal. And I think Brussels is aware of that. They don't really want us to leave without a deal. But they've got to move very quickly now.
Anna Soubry used to be a Conservative MP but left because of Brexit. She's furious about the plan.
Our country is in the biggest crisis since the Second World War. Boris Johnson is determined we're going to crash out of the European Union without a deal. And so what he is doing is he's suspending Parliament when it should be sitting because he is determined to do something for which he has no mandate at all.
Shortly before we recorded this podcast, I spoke to our political correspondent, Tony Bonsignori.
Let me give you a little bit of context here. So the way it works here in Westminster, in the House of Commons, is that we go back to the Commons. MPs return to the Commons in early September. That's going to happen next Wednesday. And then from there, we then get another break. We were expecting it mid-September to around the 8th of October. It's called conference recess. And why it's there is so that MPs can go off to their party conferences and discuss policies, then come back refreshed with lots of ideas. Now, that was the expectation. And if anything, yesterday, MPs were talking about trying to force through legislation which should actually reduce that recess, increase the number of days that MPs are sitting in the Commons. And what's happened today is Boris Johnson has simply blown all that up and he said no. In fact, I'm going to close Parliament rather from the 10th of September all the way through to the 14th of October. So Parliament is going to be closed, the House of Commons, for 23 working days, a huge amount of time. And of course, time that MPs opposed to a no-deal Brexit and MPs opposed to Brexit full stop were banking on to be able to try and outmaneuver the government. And as it looks right now, they've been outmaneuvered themselves.
I mean, the big question is this even democratic? Because a lot of politicians are saying it's not.
Well, that depends who you ask. Let me give you the two different sides of the story. Now, what the government and its supporters will say is, well, this is a new government. Therefore, it is normal for a new government to effectively dissolve Parliament. It's called prorogation. That's the jargon that we use here. Effectively get rid of this parliament and start a new one after a period of time. Now, it's happened before. Sometimes it only closes for a few days. Sometimes it closes for a few weeks. This will be 23 working days if the dates we've got turn out to be accurate. And they say that's just normal. And then when they come back, we'll get this thing called a Queen's Speech where they set out their priorities. And Boris Johnson is saying, look, this is a new government. We want to set out our new priorities on the police and health and all the different things that we want to focus on as a government. If you ask critics, though, they'll say this is utterly cynical. This is simply reducing the time that MPs, the opportunity the MPs have to have their voices heard. And in the last few minutes, we've had the Speaker of the House of the Commons, no friend of the government, but a hugely important man, who effectively oversees the House of Commons, saying this is a constitutional outrage. The former finance minister here, till just a few weeks ago, Philip Hammond, has just tweeted, this also, he says, is a constitutional outrage. So battle lines are being drawn and both sides are seeing this in a very different way.
Now, as you mentioned, opposition parties, they agreed to some kind of plan yesterday to stop no-deal Brexit. What can they do now?
Well, that feels like a very long time ago now. Yesterday, what they agreed, opposition parties, all of whom were opposed to the UK leaving the EU on the 31st of October without any deal, they agreed to go down a legislative route first. And by that, I mean they were discussing, they agreed to come up with a plan whereby they would try and get legislation through the House of Commons, which would in turn force the government to seek an extension to Brexit from the EU. It appears that has all gone now, and they're only going to have a few days next week, MPs, to try and stop the government, and it looks like it will be a vote of no confidence. But the government says even then it might just dissolve Parliament and call an election for after November the 1st. Really an extraordinary situation here.
That was Tony Bonsignori. And just after we recorded that interview, Britain's main opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn, announced that he'll try to bring in legislation next week to stop Boris Johnson from suspending Parliament in the run-up to Britain's scheduled withdrawal from the EU. Mr Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party, added that he'd then table a motion of no confidence in Mr Johnson at some point. For a sense of how the European Union is reacting to the news, I spoke to Adam Fleming, our correspondent in Brussels.
We've had some reaction at a political level through various tweets. Guy Verhofstadt, who is an MEP, a member of the European Parliament and their Brexit coordinator, has quoted the campaign slogan from the Leave campaign in the referendum, taking back control. He said, that has never looked so sinister as today. Then we heard from Norbert Röttgen, a German MP and chairman of their Foreign Affairs Committee, who's close to Angela Merkel, who says, or asks, how does respect for democracy go together with suspending Parliament? And then Nathalie Loiseau, a French member of the European Parliament, who used to be their European Affairs Minister and is pretty close to Emmanuel Macron, the French president, says, what disease does British democracy suffer from that means fear of debate before making one of the most important decisions in its history? So that's the politicians. In terms of the technicians at the European Commission who do the Brexit talks day to day, they've not really commented officially. Their spokeswoman said that it's not a matter for them to comment on the domestic political procedures inside an EU member state. But I had a text from a source close to the negotiators who says, whatever happens, the EU is never going to change its position just because no deal had become a more credible threat from the UK, or the opponents of no deal in the UK had got a bit more organised. I think what they really mean is, for the EU, nothing has changed, because all they really care about is there going to be a withdrawal agreement that can get through the British Parliament? Everything else is just noise, no matter how big and dramatic the noise is.
That was Adam Fleming. After initially rejecting a $22 million offer to help fight fires in the Amazon rainforest, a spokesman for the Brazilian president, Jair Bolsonaro, has said he now welcomes aid as long as his government can decide how to spend it. Our correspondent Sophie Long reports now from the heart of the Amazon.
We took a helicopter over the rainforest in the Xingu Basin in order to survey the damage there. We saw a significant area that was still burning. Our guide told me that what we were looking at was a fire intentionally set on farmland, but it was extremely close to indigenous land where a community lives in almost total isolation. It means that they also have almost no means by which to put out fires started by others. Their fate, therefore, is almost entirely in the government's hands. I met a group of indigenous leaders. I asked one of them, a leader of the Shipaya community, what the main threat to his people was. This is what he told me.
One of the biggest threats my people face today is our government. They are trying to destroy the Amazon, to exterminate our people. They are the people trying to destroy our country and the Amazon.
Now, some of the blame has been directed at farmers. President Bolsonaro has a large support base among the agricultural community here. According to current rules, farmers are allowed to clear up to 20% of their land. One of the problems, though, is when those legal fires get out of control. I spoke to Adelardo Corva. His family have farmed here near Altamira for nearly 30 years. He told me this is a storm in a teacup, that fires happen every year, that farmers are certainly not to blame, and nor is their president.
It's people acting illegally who want to claim the forest. Farmers who own registered land don't burn and they don't deforest.
Now, the Corva family, Adelardo and his children, made us really welcome. They wanted to tell us what they said was the real story. But we had to leave their land very promptly as a crowd had gathered who were angry with the media and the way their country and their president have been portrayed.
Sophie Long. As news began emerging of the fires in the Amazon, people around the world began wondering what they could do to help. And one company has been a beneficiary of that. Ecosia is an internet search engine that contributes 80% of its profits to planting trees. They've seen a huge surge in downloads since the reports of the Amazon fires. Their chief executive, Christian Kroll, told Dan Damon how they operate.
If people use us as their search engine, then we basically generate funds for planting trees in the Amazon.
And there's been a huge increase in the number of people willing to do that in just the last few days. Is that right?
Yes. So since the fires in the Amazon started, we saw a huge uptick in user numbers. So basically, on a normal day, we would have something like 20,000 people who start using Ecosia. But now, over the weekend, for example, we had over 400,000 people every day installing our app. The more people use us as their search engine, the more funds we're able to generate. So that means the more trees we can plant. But of course, planting trees is not the only solution. You also need to make sure that these trees actually stay standing and that trees around the areas where you're planting trees are not getting burned down. So what we do in our projects is that we talk very actively with the farmers in the areas, and we're actually even participating in firefighting to make sure that the trees that are standing around the trees that we're planting also stay there.
Tell us about one or two of those farmers in Brazil. You've got them, I think, in other countries too, Ethiopia, Madagascar, but tell us about the Brazilian partners.
One of the people that I personally find most inspiring is Severino, who's leading the tree planting project, and he's basically giving all his energy to make sure that the farmers, the local farmers, understand how cutting down or burning down the forests will actually affect them negatively in the future.
What is the contradiction? Because you can imagine if you're a farmer and you want to run more cattle, then chopping down the trees is the way to expand your business.
I think this is a typical issue that people kind of use up resources until it's too late. So I think in economics, you call this the tragedy of the commons, where people overuse resources. And by doing that, basically overall, like the community is worse off in the end. So people cut down rainforests until the Amazon isn't able to sustain itself anymore, which means that then you won't have regular rainfalls anymore, which means that the land where you cut down trees earlier will slowly degrade and turn into very infertile land. And that means that everybody in the end will be worse off. But as long as there's no good policy preventing that, individual actors will just keep doing what is best for them or what's in their own economic interests. And that's unfortunately cutting down or burning down trees.
That was Christian Kroll, the chief executive of Ecosia, speaking to Dan Damon. Now for some news about another BBC World Service podcast that I think you'll enjoy. 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy tells the fascinating stories of inventions, ideas and innovations which have shaped the world we live in. We're into the second season now, and among the treats in store is a tale of how a disgruntled postal service customer changed the world with the invention of the stamp. If that sparks your interest, just search for 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy wherever you found this podcast. And still to come in this edition of Global News.
I wouldn't believe it's about security, it's about control. It's about control and maintaining the oppression against the whole society, especially children.
The Palestinian children who are prisoners in Israeli jails. Purdue, the American drug maker owned by the billionaire Sackler family, is in discussion to settle more than 2,000 opioid lawsuits. The company produces the OxyContin painkiller and is prepared to spend between $10 and $12 billion. Purdue and the Sacklers have denied allegations that they marketed prescription painkillers aggressively while masking the risks involved in their prolonged use. Around 130 Americans die every day from an opioid overdose. The statement by Purdue comes a day after a judge in the US state of Oklahoma ordered another drug company, Johnson & Johnson, to pay a fine of nearly $600 million for its part in fueling an epidemic of pain-killing opioids in the state. Harry Nelson, a US healthcare lawyer, says the money offered by Purdue would have little impact on efforts to solve the wider opioid crisis.
The cost of actually addressing the harm caused in the opioid crisis is roughly $500 billion. So another 10 to 12 billion would be literally a drop in the bucket, about 2% of what we need globally to solve this crisis. So there's a lot more work ahead and a lot more money needed to stop the tide of overdose drug deaths, to treat the people who are addicted, and to actually prevent this crisis from just getting worse and worse.
Ohio is one of the most severely affected states in the U.S., with no less than 1,500 opioid lawsuits brought by the state, local and tribal authorities. The first two trials are expected in October. Haley Nelson is a reporter for the WSYX TV station in Columbus who's covered this story. And Lawrence Pollard asked her what she made of the Purdue announcement.
This has been the big story in Ohio for years now. I think there are a lot of folks, whether their families impacted by, you know, losing a loved one or people still fighting their own addictions, they want some sort of acknowledgement that wrongdoing occurred here. And I do think there are a lot of people that want to see something play out in the court system. Whether or not we get that at this point, obviously, still remains up in the air.
And you've had individual cases which are going through at the moment, as well as this big federal one as well. Just tell us about that. What's the picture in terms of sort of individual suits and payments?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I've met and interviewed quite a few people that, you know, for a lot of them, their addiction started in a doctor's office. Perhaps it was some sort of a sports injury. That's something I've heard from a lot of young adults, got prescribed quite a large amount of opioids. And then when that kind of more legal pipeline for that medication ran out, then they turned to getting these drugs on the streets. And I think right now here locally, that's what we're dealing with. A lot of it's people, the illegal trade of drugs, and our big issue right now in the Columbus area, in the central Ohio area, is fentanyl. So we still get a majority of our overdose deaths are fentanyl related. And this is something that while we are seeing across Ohio a drop in overdose deaths, we still have one of the highest death rates in the United States. So it's still very much an issue on a lot of people's minds. And I think a lot of former addicts that I've talked to, people in recovery, I think they are watching this very closely and they want to get some sort of answers. And I think that's why these court cases mean so much.
And when the payments, if the payments are made, do we have any idea who they're made to, how they're made? I mean, is it specifically named patients who are going to get claims? Is it a sort of a class action, to use that phrase, that's done on behalf of people? I'm just interested, who's going to come forward and manage this enormous amount of money that's being spoken about?
Yeah, and that's kind of what, from my understanding, a lot of what they're trying to work out right now. Because like you mentioned, I mean, these are local governments, tribal governments. So I think there's still
some work going on in the court system to try to determine, you know, if we do come to a settlement, how will this all play out?
Hayley Nelson, a reporter for the WSYX station in Columbus, Ohio, speaking to Lawrence Pollard. In July, Israel's Supreme Court turned down a petition to allow Palestinian children detained in Israeli prisons the right to phone their parents. It once again put a spotlight on the Israeli system of juvenile military courts, the only one of its kind in the world. Critics say these courts breach several international laws on human rights, but Israel rejects these claims. Megha Mohan reports from the West Bank.
The journey to the jail begins at 5:45 a.m. for Nabil. His 16-year-old son Mahmoud has been detained for stone throwing. The family get to visit Mahmoud once a month. The jail is less than an hour away, but due to Israeli checkpoints, the journey can take up to 6 hours.
You're going to see the trouble we go through.
The checkpoints. Issues with the checkpoints. Searching. Come forward. Go backward. Go there. And the machine beeps. It's a mess. It's exhausting. It's torture. As if we're also detained.
Every year, more than 500 Palestinian children, some as young as 12, are arrested by Israeli forces in communities in the West Bank. The most common charge is stone throwing. Israel is the only country in the world where children are prosecuted through a dedicated juvenile military court system. Saha Francis, a lawyer for Adamir, an organisation that advocates for Palestinian prisoners in the West Bank, says the issue is both moral and legal.
You raid a house after midnight in order to arrest a 14-year-old boy. It's not just against the boy himself. It's against the whole family. Imagine the father and the mother that they cannot protect their son. I wouldn't believe it's about security. It's about control. It's about control and maintaining the oppression against the whole society, especially children.
Israel says the charges can be more serious than stone throwing. Malak Al-Galbraith was arrested at a checkpoint at the age of 14 for an alleged knife attack on Israeli soldiers. She says she was made to sign a confession in Hebrew, a language she doesn't understand.
Then they took me to a military camp in Jerusalem. There they interrogated me. She was yelling at me. She wanted me to sign a paper in Hebrew. She was asking me very strange questions, and I said, no, I haven't done anything. She forced me to sign the paper.
As the Israeli military's chief prosecutor, Morris Hirsch prepared indictments against thousands of Palestinians, including hundreds of children.
I often hear the claim that Palestinian minors are interrogated and forced to sign a confession in Hebrew. Great claim. But it's simply not true. And I saw the evidence.
If that's never happened.
I came into the prosecution probably in 2003. Most of the statements of the Palestinian minors are written in Arabic.
Most of it, but they set up to...
One second. Those that are written in Hebrew, no child was prosecuted based on a statement written in Hebrew.
At a checkpoint that Nabil has to cross to see his son Mahmoud in prison, we're stopped for an hour and a half while soldiers question us as to why we're travelling with Palestinian families to a jail without prior notification. Worried that press may attract undue attention, we leave Nabil to continue his journey to see his son for the 45 minutes they have together this month.
That report by Megha Mohan. A report issued by the charity Save the Children and the Overseas Development Institute says poverty among children in Africa will make up more than half of all extreme global poverty by the end of the next decade. The head of Save the Children UK and the joint author of the report is Kevin Watkins. And Shaima Khalil asked why the problem should be so deep at a time when many African nations are enjoying rapid economic growth.
There are some really encouraging developments in Africa. More and more children are getting into school, child survival rates are improving, there's some progress in nutrition. And yet the very stark fact is that the world just a few years ago pledged to eradicate world poverty by 2030. And the data that we set out, I think, points unambiguously to a world in 2030 in which over 300 million African children will be living in poverty. They'll account for over half of all extreme poverty in the world in 2030. And it's really the result of two things, which is, first of all, the poorest people in Africa are not benefiting sufficiently from the economic growth that's happening, from the opportunities that are arising. And secondly, Africa has the advantage of a very youthful population. You know, the median age is around 18 compared to 40 in the United Kingdom. But governments have really struggled to create education opportunities for those children. And it's really education that could lift the region out of poverty.
How did you come to the figures that led you to this conclusion, though? Is it, as you say, looking at the poorest communities and realizing that what, in the last 10 years, they didn't benefit from economic growth? There was no social mobility, for example.
You know, if you take a country like Kenya, Kenya is doing very well on average as a country. The north of Kenya is being left further and further behind. And what I think our data is highlighting, we looked at the growth trends for Africa across the region. We looked at the demographic trends, and demography is incredibly important in Africa. You know, this is the one part of the world that hasn't gone through a demographic transition. The average fertility rates were around 5 compared to just under 3 in South Asia, for example. And of course, the initial depth of poverty, so the starting point of poor people in Africa, is much further back than it is in other parts of the world. And on top of all that, you've got very extreme patterns of inequality in many countries. Now, when you put that mix together, you end up with those appalling child poverty figures that we set out in the paper.
Kevin Watkins, the head of Save the Children UK, speaking to Shaima Khalil. The American rocket company SpaceX has conducted a successful flight of its Starhopper vehicle, part of an effort to develop a new engine which runs on liquid methane. It burns cleaner than kerosene and is easier to handle than liquid hydrogen, the other two major rocket fuels used today. Our science correspondent Jonathan Amos has been telling me more about Starhopper.
They say it looks a little bit like a water tower. if you can imagine that sort of typical American object that would deliver water, on a farm or something like that. But it has this rocket underneath it, and they fired it late on Tuesday, and it lifted up to about 150 metres, moved 100 metres across, and then set itself down. And now they'll retire it. It's a prototype, a development sort of device to help them progress this Raptor engine. Now, currently, SpaceX, we all know them. They have these rockets. They go up, they come down. But they're going to move to an even bigger rocket in the future, which they call the Starship. And it has a big booster with it as well, which they call Super Heavy. And that won't use the kerosene-fueled engines that they currently do. They will use methane-fueled engines because, as you described, it's a cleaner, easier-to-handle type of fuel. And this is really the start for them. And they're now going to progress to bigger and bigger prototypes to develop this engine. And for the future, well, we're going to see SpaceX do some quite interesting things. They're talking about using this future vehicle called the Starship to go to the moon, to go to Mars, to even use it as a point-to-point means of travel. So today we get on a big jumbo jet and we might go from New York to Sydney. In future, we might use a rocket-type vehicle, which would go up and then come down, but would do it much, much faster than a jumbo jet would. So an interesting first start for this little squat vehicle, the Starhopper. As I say, it looks like a water tower in Texas, doing this 150-metre high jump, but bigger things to come.
That was Jonathan Amos. Finally, the American bulk buy retailer Costco has opened its first physical store in China. Unfortunately, though, it was forced to close early on its opening day after too many people showed up. Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen, told me what happened.
Well, there have been these pictures all over social media today showing people literally, when the shutters came up, fighting, crawling into the store, running in, fights over roast chicken even, trying to get some goods. And I've not seen this for a while, actually. There have been stampedes previous years in big Western supermarkets in China for people to get access to sale goods, because a lot of these goods are normally quite expensive. But yeah, Costco opening, obviously it comes amidst a US-Chinese trade war, and there's this call in media for boycotts of US products. But yeah, all over media today, talk of this huge frenzy to try and get goods at Costco.
Yeah, there's a photo of the man selling hot chickens and he looks like he's under siege from the amount of people trying to get them. So is this a culture clash or is it something else?
Well, it's a number of things. People like to get their hands on goods that are either limited edition or cheap. But also, I mean, because this trade war is going on, people are thinking that because they're being told by the media that something's bad, it almost makes it quite exciting. So yeah, in Shanghai, lots and lots of people trying to get their hands on goods just to say that they can. But obviously Costco is back open today, but they have had to make some changes since because people were struggling to get into the store. There were queues for 3 hours for people to actually get into the car park. And they've said that today they're going to implement a restriction on only 2,000 people being allowed into the store on any day.
That was Kerry Allen, our China media analyst. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and until next time, goodbye.